The following program for blind and print-impaired listeners is a production of the North Carolina Reading Service. And it's the Indie Week, and it's read today by John Federson. This issue dated September the 28th of 2023. Right, and here we go. First up, a new North Carolina Children's Hospital is to open somewhere in the Triangle in the next 8 to 10 years. Cy Neff writes, casinos got the chop in the North Carolina budget passed last week, but Medicaid expansion stayed in as promised. Along with its launch in December comes a major investment in health care across the state with massive implications for the Triangle. Included in the new state budget was a $320 million initial investment for the North Carolina Children's Hospital, what UNC health leaders and state lawmakers hope will become a world-class, nationally renowned children's hospital based somewhere in the Triangle. Alan Wolf, the director of news and media relations for UNC Health, writes, says the idea is that this would be a freestanding flagship hospital, basically the first of its kind in North Carolina. North Carolina needs a children's hospital that can be the pride of the state. We want to be able to treat the next generations of children right here in North Carolina and not have to have them go out of state to get the best care. The Triangle already has several children's hospital options, including Duke's nationally ranked 190-bed Children's Health and Hospital Center in Durham, UNC Healthcare's 150-bed Children's Hospital in Chapel Hill, and Wake Med's 45-bed Children's Hospital in Raleigh. Just last fall, however, Children's Hospital in the Triangle saw a shortage of bed availability during a respiratory illness surge. And Raleigh and Durham ranked as the fourth fastest-growing cities in the United States last year. In addition to medical care, the new Children's Hospital will provide behavioral health services and include a child and adolescent psychiatric hospital. Following the outbreak of the pandemic, especially adolescent behavioral and mental health has become an increasing point of concern. Parenthetically, it says this facility is unrelated to another 54-bed adolescent center that UNC Health plans to open later this year in Butner. Stephanie Davis, chief physician at UNC Children's, said in a press release, these investments will transform the care of children across the state, ensure a healthier future for North Carolina's children, and shape the future of behavioral health care for all children by providing the highest level of comprehensive care and improving health outcomes for future generations. As the hospital is in its early planning stages, concrete details like site location and financing are uncertain at this time. Wolf says, we know we want it in the Triangle, a visible area that's going to be close to the big population centers, presumably the airport as well, so folks can fly in from across the state if they need to. As to financing, Wolf says the bulk of the remaining funding for the estimated $2 billion project will come from philanthropic fundraising and UNC Health's capital reserves. Officials say the new hospital will create thousands of new local jobs. Next steps will include fundraising, identifying a site, and designing the new facilities. To UNC health leaders, the new hospital symbolizes a deeper investment in health care in the state. Wesley Burks, CEO of UNC Health and Dean of the UNC School of Medicine, said, this is a monumental partnership for our state's health care future. He adds, the UNC Health is incredibly appreciative of state leaders for their recognition that health care has some areas that can improve. They're looking ahead to the next 10 or 20 years. If we're going to continue to see the population grow in North Carolina the way it is, a number of children that are being treated in our hospitals and emergency departments, we're going to need additional facilities to help them be cared for. I may jump around a little bit in this issue. Chase Pellegrini de Power has written on the 21st, as Chapel Hill leaders consider long-term plan for housing affordability, they also fight to preserve existing stock. Richard Gerlitz, a Chapel Hill-based architect, found himself facing an unfriendly town council meeting last week. He had presented early plans for the Reserve at Blue Hill, a 212-unit apartment complex meant to replace the current 65-unit King's Arms on Ephesus Church Road, and it was time for the public and council to comment. The new development would be taller, fancier, and, as council members noted, pricier. All 65 of the King's Arms units were considered affordable. Only 35 of the new units would be. Some current residents of King's Arms sat through the meeting, grumbling and shaking their heads at renderings of cementitious panels, synthetic wood accents, and floor-to-ceiling windows. They also took to the podium to share their fears. One resident said, to applause, "In Hawaii, they have a saying, it's not heaven if the locals can't afford to live here." Well, it's not the southern part of heaven if the locals can't afford to live here. "Folks, please," said Mayor Pam Heminger as she tried to keep order in the chamber, asking the crowd to wave their hands instead of clapping. Maybe an earlier council would have been more friendly to Gerlitz's presentation, but with new affordable housing development plan and investment strategy on the agenda for later that night, council members were eager to show constituents they were serious about affordability. Member Michael Parker says, "We, as a council, have expressed the goal of and recognize this community needs more housing, but what we can't have is a decrease in the existing affordable housing. That's just an economic issue, but more importantly, is a human issue." Mayor Pro Tem Karen Stegman said, "The applicant shouldn't be surprised that this is where this conversation is going, if you paid any attention to this council. And coming without even a real proposal for consideration is really a problem for me." The council didn't take a vote on the future of that development this week. The hope is Gerlitz will come back with a proposal to preserve more affordable units. After they finished expressing their displeasure with Gerlitz, the council moved on to discussion of the town's affordable development plan and investment strategy, designed to guide policy over the next 5 years. It passed with unanimous approval. Philip Cash of HRNA Advisors, one of the town's partners who helped develop the plan, says, "I feel like there's always an appropriate presentation before I come on," he joked. The 91-page document assesses the town's current affordable housing efforts and provides recommendations, quote, "to reduce barriers to building homes, expand and preserve affordable homeownership, expand and preserve affordable rental housing, and increase staff and funding capacity." The document also looks to address racial discrepancies, citing higher prices as a displacement pressure that has caused a 32% decline in black homeownership in Chapel Hill since 2010. By supporting construction of townhouses and duplexes, the missing middle between standalone single-family homes and large apartment complexes, the plan would attempt to change a pattern of, quote, "historic discrimination and inequities in homeownership for black households, most often seen in redlining and restrictive covenants." Another recommendation is to create relocation assistance packages for renters like those in King's Arms who are at risk of displacement or eviction. Sarah Venus, town's director of affordable housing and community connections, said, "Affordable housing, as we've heard this evening already, continues to be one of our community's greatest challenges, and it also is one of our council's highest priorities. We believe that everyone in the community should have a safe and affordable place to call home." Venus emphasized the plan included both short and long-term changes. The first two steps would be to calibrate the town's inclusionary zoning policy and identify funding sources. Those sources were the biggest sticking point for some of the council members. The five-year plan would require $10 million a year to implement the new recommendations, while simply sustaining the pre-existing levels of funding impacts would only require $7 million annually. While the plan included suggestions for how to raise that money, including a new housing bond and a penny tax, it didn't sugarcoat the fact it would not be an easy journey. Council members Amy Ryan told Venus and Cash, "I support the strategy that you have. I think this is brilliant. The place that I'm getting heartburn is the money." Instead of trying to quiet the audience, most of the council members joined in the clapping after their vote of approval. Gerlitz, the architect, was nowhere to be seen. Hopefully this won't come, the next article won't come as a major surprise for anyone here, but some of this housing development and future strategies is remotely connected to elections coming up. And in Chapel Hill, in Kerry, the town of Kerry, this article wants us to meet the candidates for three seats on the Kerry Town Council. Early voting is already underway, as I hope we know. And by the way, if you're going to vote early voting, you need photo ID now. Three seats are up for grabs in the Kerry Council. In October 2019, only about 15% of registered voters in Kerry's 41 precincts even cast ballots in the local elections. With influences important issues like affordable housing, social justice, and policing, not to mention the environment. Here's our guide to this year's candidates. So first of all, it reminds you that through October 7th, you got early voting at Monday through Friday, 8 to 3, and 1 to 6 on Saturday, and 11 a.m. to 6 Monday through Friday, 8 to 3 on Saturday, 1 to 6 on Sunday. Wake County voters can go to Herbert Young Community Center. Chatham County can go to the New Hope Baptist Church on New Hope Church Road in Apex. Municipal Election Day is October 10th. Visit your county board of elections for information about where and when to vote. Driver's license or other acceptable photo is required. You can still receive a free voter ID through the Wake County Board of Elections. So, incumbent mayor Harold Weinbrick Jr. is running unopposed this year following an overwhelming win in 2019 when he was reelected with nearly 84% of the vote. He's been Kerry's mayor for the last 16 years. Under his leadership, Kerry's town council is unlikely to undergo significant political shifts. For the past 4 years, the town council has had a record of balanced growth, working to protect and expand green spaces while adding affordable housing. The town council has also taken steps to promote multimodal transportation, building more sidewalks and bike lanes. On housing, the council has a decent record, partnering last year with a developer on a Laurel Street project on town-owned land, but it is struggling to keep up with rapid growth like many areas in the county. In 2021, the town council approved a new housing plan that builds on its 2017 vision, quote, retaining Kerry's established attractive residential character while facilitating the development of walkable urban nodes with higher densities and mixed uses. In the past few years, the town has improved its record on social justice. Kerry has historically scored less than 20 out of 100 on the Human Rights Campaign Municipal Equality Index, which rates cities on how inclusive their laws, policies, and services are for their LGBTQ residents. In the town's most recent 2022 rating, the score went up to 50, thanks to several changes by the town council. But now that's the mayor. Here are the candidates running for three seats on the council. One is at large, one is in District B, and one District D. The at large, we have Lori Bush, an incumbent, a long-term Kerry resident who has expressed concern about the growth and impact on neighborhoods. First elected in 2011, she's running for her fourth term. She's also served as mayor pro tem. In the last 4 years, Bush supported initiatives to partner with Habitat for Humanity for new home construction, create food waste and compost drop-off programs, and incorporate solar power into town infrastructure. She also brought Wake County's LGBTQ non-discrimination ordinance forward for approval and created a diversity, equity, and inclusion task force. If reelected, her priorities include affordable housing and climate change, further supporting pedestrians and cyclists, according to her responses to a questionnaire from the Democratic Party. She has been endorsed by the Democratic Party, Equality, NC, Sierra Club, and Moms Demand Action. Next, a candidate for at-large, Mary Innsbrucker, who ran for town council last year against Jack Smith. She's taking another swing at public office. Her questionnaire is here, and they include a link. A 17-year resident of Cary describes herself as a moderate whose platform includes eliminating polarizing and divisive politics. She has a website. On a question about supporting LGBTQ residents and ensuring their safety, Innsbrucker did not directly address issues of equality, but instead pledged to support the town's police force and work with them to guarantee focused deterrence and protective policing. A robust police force is also listed on her top priorities on her website. A former town consultant, Innsbrucker says she shares residents' concern about overdevelopment and affordable housing, per her answers to that questionnaire. If elected, she intends to execute a plan she previously developed to get corporate philanthropic support for affordable housing, she says. On the environment, she supports multimodal transportation and green development, particularly managing stormwater. Then Matthew Gronke, another nearly lifelong resident of Cary, is a stay-at-home dad who also works with nonprofit Triangle Off-Road Cyclists to build and maintain local mountain biking trails. Gronke argues that current town government is, quote, inactive and unresponsive to the needs of the community, and if elected, intends to be more open to projects that directly benefit the community. Gronke, who says Cary has not lived up to his bike-friendly messages, says one of his priorities is the creation of more bike lanes downtown. All right, now those are candidates for the at-large position. And for District B, we have the incumbent, Mayor Pro Tem Don France, a resident since 1992. He's been first elected in 2007 and served 16 years. He, quote, has a keen interest in being the voice of old Cary, from his official online biography. And he currently represents District B, Cary, downtown Cary, Wake Med Soccer, and extends north to Lake Crabtree. He takes a practical approach to housing, writing on his blog, the city needs to increase supply to meet ongoing demand. He supports Cary's 2021 housing plan, including building affordable housing on city-owned land, improving transit through investments in bus service and bicycles, and allowing denser housing, duplexes, triplexes, townhomes, and apartments. Next candidate, Michelle Craig, a Wake County public school teacher, bought her first home 10 years ago in Cary. As a PTA member, Craig has taken the lead on issues of education advocacy, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Equality is one of her top priorities, according to her website. In answers to a WCP Democratic Party questionnaire, Craig says she wants to look at historic preservation through an equity lens and strengthen support and advocacy for LGBTQ community. On affordable housing, Craig wants to create more opportunities for seniors, recent graduates, teachers, and other essential workers. She supports zoning changes to allow for accessory dwelling units and denser development. Also wants to, quote, further explore mixed-income housing. Another priority for Craig is the environment. If elected, she's pledged to increase the tree canopy, expand public transportation, and support sidewalks, greenways, and bike lanes, as well as green construction provisions. She has been endorsed by the Democratic Party and Equality NC. For District D, the final seat that is on the council, the incumbent Ryan Eads was appointed last year to replace former council member Yao Liu as she was elected to the State House. He'll face his actual first election this year. A recent transplant to Kerry, having moved here in 2010. He represents District D, and that includes the western outskirts of Kerry near Chatham County and a section of North Carolina 540. Prior to his appointment, Eads served on the town's Planning and Zoning Board from 2014 to 2020. In 2017, he worked on the town's Imagine Kerry Community Plan, a comprehensive plan for future development. On housing, Eads supports mixed-use development with commercial and office space, according to his website. He also advocates preserving Kerry's historic structures and encouraging economic growth through investment in local sports venues. His priorities also include increasing access to greenways, sidewalks, and public transit. He's a proponent of expanding the town's tree canopy using environmentally friendly storm water management techniques in new developments and preserving open space. He has been endorsed by Kerry Mayor Harold Weinbrack and District C Councilmember Jack Smith. And Sarika Bansal was another finalist for that District D seat. If elected, Bansal would be the first Indian American woman to serve on the town council. The Asian and Indian population in Kerry has grown in recent years, with Asian residents representing about 20% of Kerry's population in 2022. She moved to Kerry in 2015, eventually starting her own small business. She lists public safety among her priorities, pledging to fill vacancies in the police department and invest in a diverse police force and de-escalation training. Adding, she's committed to police transparency, accountability, and community dialogue. She plans to get construction moving on community centers in West Kerry, help clean up the town's drinking water, and expand bike infrastructure and public transport. She also supports effort by current council to create more affordable housing, prioritizing the needs of senior citizens. She also wants to invest in local businesses and work with Wake County School Board to reduce school overcrowding. And finally, Rachel Jordan, who moved here in 2016 with her husband and daughter, volunteering with the Democratic Party and PTA. In this Democratic Party questionnaire, she argues the current town council has, quote, consistently underestimated what actions are needed to ensure housing equity and environmental sustainability. If elected, she plans to push developers to build more affordable apartments than the 5% currently being requested by council. She also wants to change the town's formulas for determining eligibility for housing assistance to reflect Kerry's higher median income and housing costs. On the environment, she plans to expand environmental building guidelines and implement stronger carbon reduction strategies. She strongly supports LGBTQ community, saying the town should make extra effort to protect groups at risk of persecution and public libraries that have been attacked for carrying inclusive books. And she has been endorsed by the Wake County Democratic Party. So that's the introduction to the candidates for these three seats on the town council. The next article takes us to the Durham City Council and an at-large seat and a candidate, a single candidate for this at-large seat. That doesn't mean he's the only candidate. But Carol Rist, age 60, who identifies as a Democrat, has a campaign website. That's carolfordurham.com. And Carol Rist, R-I-S-T. This article is a question and answer, and unfortunately for Mr. Rist, this goes on for six dense pages, and I don't have time to read it all, and so I'll be summarizing as best I can his election website, his campaign website. And he's lived in Durham for 34 years. He's an independent consultant and self-employed. Please identify the three most pressing issues you believe Durham faces and how you believe the city should address them. Again, we're going to ask you to go to Indy Week if you want to see the entirety of his answers, which are very itemized, detailed, I must say. Durham is an amazing place to live, but there are a number of pressing issues that affect livability. First, as I meet voters across Durham, it's abundantly clear that access to safe and affordable housing is one of the two most important issues in Durham. The City Council must do a number of things: develop additional permanent supportive housing for vulnerable citizens, provide support for the Durham Housing Authority and nonprofits, provide down payment assistance for more first-time low-income home buyers, encourage private development of affordable housing using planning and zoning and common sense changes to the existing code. That's number one. Second, homicides on the rise. Durham must address issues of community safety. True safety will only be achieved when everyone has a good paying job, affordable health care, a great school, and an affordable home. Ultimately, these should be the goals of every elected official. In the meantime, we need guns off our streets. We absolutely must lobby our legislators to pass common sense gun legislation. In our current state of a Republican supermajority, this seems unlikely to happen. He fully supports increasing funding for the HEART program, of which I've been a strong supporter. And we've read many articles about that HEART program. I applaud the city's council's recent decision to expand HEART citywide. And then the third issue, Durham needs greater shared economic prosperity. Despite a thriving economy and low unemployment, one in seven residents is poor, and 40% live below 200% of poverty. To combat this, a number of things the city could do to increase economic opportunity. Work with partners like Durham Tech and Made in Durham to connect more young people, especially those from disinvested communities. Encourage more living wage jobs by promoting social marketing efforts like the Durham Living Wage Project and strengthening the incentive policy. Support more residents to succeed as entrepreneurs by following the model of innovative cities like Baltimore, Kansas City, and Long Beach that have developed robust entrepreneurial ecosystems to support entrepreneurs. Partner with local civic organizations in Durham, including churches, to help build household wealth by erasing medical debt. Cities like Chicago are already doing this. Additional support from the city of Durham in the form of match or other incentives could leverage additional community investment. And endow nest egg savings accounts for public school students starting in kindergarten. Local nonprofits should already provide such savings account for their participants in college. The city of Durham should work with DPS to scale this type of asset building strategy to more kids in Durham. So that's just the first part of his three issues that he believes are the most important. The other questions: what in your record as a public official or other experience demonstrates your ability to be effective as a member of the city council? And he answers that. What's the best or most important thing the council has done in the past year? And he says, as he had before, expanding HEART citywide. Gun violence is the question number four. At present, there are too many guns on the streets. And he gives some more detail about the boost pay for police officers is one of his. Create an Office of Survivor Care. Expand Durham's basic income program, known as Excel, to serve more citizens returning from prison. Pass a fair chance housing ordinance. And then what can the city be doing to support people who are not in control of their own housing, including renters, the unhoused, and those whose homes are owned by banks, as the cost of living skyrocket? So this questionnaire goes on for several more questions, and I will not read its entirety, as I've mentioned. Carl Rist, you can go to IndyWeek.com right now, and you can see that article in its entirety. This is simply a questionnaire, and this does not involve a specific recommendation by the Indy staff for voting. The next article, Grace Vitaglione has written, North Carolina politics, still a tough play for millennials and Generation Z. Eleazar Posada, a member of the Carrboro Town Council, never imagined he'd run for office. As a queer Latino millennial, he knew his background was different from that of most politicians. His mother organized farm workers in Texas. His family was homeless for a brief period in his childhood, and he made tacos with his mother to sell before school. He said, "My mom always instilled in us that family and community is what we got, and we have their back, and they'll have our back." Posada said he's glad to defy the usual expectations of an elected official. Despite the emergence of young leaders like 30-year-old Posada, North Carolina's political landscape remains dominated by older officials. While political action committees and civic engagement nonprofits are working to help young candidates run and win elections, challenges like campaign costs, low pay, and redistricting make it difficult for young people to succeed in politics. Removing some of these barriers for campaigns could help usher in a new generation of diverse leaders. Few young people hold elected positions in the state, similar to states like Georgia, South Carolina, and Virginia. Brittany Anlar, lead graduate research assistant at the Young Elected Leaders Project, conducted a study from 2018 to 2022 that found less than 10% of young officials aged 18 to 35 in these states' lower chambers and showed a persistent absence of young lawmakers or never holding more than 10% of the seats. In contrast, states like Florida and Minnesota consistently had more young leaders and a persistent presence of young people holding 10% or more of the seats during that four-year period. Three states saw a drop in young representatives, while four, Wyoming, Illinois, North Dakota, and Oregon, saw a rise. In the North Carolina General Assembly, there are 28 millennial legislators aged 27 to 42, and zero Generation Z legislators, that's ages 21 to 26, out of 170 total, Anlar found. The average age of a North Carolina lawmaker is a little over 57. About a dozen of these young state lawmakers are under 35, while the rest are millennials over age 35. In 2018, a wave of youth entered Congress, but that increase hasn't continued, said Anlar. She said many young Congress members like Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Lauren Underwood remain in office, but the advantages for incumbents make it tough for new faces to break through. One leader in the state sets an example for young people interested in politics. That's Anderson Clayton at age 25, the youngest state party chair in the nation, as head of the North Carolina Democratic Party. She's gained national attention for her efforts to sway rural voters in North Carolina toward Democrats. Organizations like Run for Something, a progressive political organization, are trying to support more young leaders in North Carolina by recruiting young people to run for office. Dozens of other organizations like Ignite and the NC Institute of Political Leadership provide resources and training for people interested in elected office. Posada has been endorsed by Run for Something for his race to hold his seat on the Carrboro Town Council this year. RFS, Run for Something, also endorsed Catherine Frayfor, Carrboro Town Council, Catherine Frey for Carrboro Town Council and Matt Hughes for Hillsborough City Council. RFS looks outside typical candidate pools like lawyers and instead recruits people like high school football coaches who have leadership skills and community ties, said Paul Bradfield, who's the Southern Regional Director of RFS. He said while part of his job is convincing people they can be they could be political candidates, he also has to prepare them for the big undertaking of campaigning. RFS often focuses on down-ballot races to increase local impact and build a bench of future leaders, said Bradfield. Part of what makes RFS unique is that they play the long game, running Democratic candidates even in heavily Republican areas in an effort to shift the electorate over time. Voters get excited about young people running for office, said Hughes, but young people interested in politics face obstacles like campaigning, low youth voter turnout, and fewer resources for candidates of color. Bradfield said campaign costs and networking are hurdles for young candidates. Young candidates with kids or rigid jobs could also find it tough to make time for campaigning. State Senator Natalie Murdoch, Democrat of Chatham and Durham, said getting campaign funding was a challenge as a black millennial woman, as many young candidates of color don't have as many resources for funding. Murdoch had to convince herself that she deserved to run. She was the first black woman under 40 elected to the North Carolina Senate. She said, "The first time someone said, 'You should run for something,' I literally laughed." Campaigning in North Carolina takes more money because it's a purple state, said State Representative Jake Johnson, Republican of Henderson, who won his first election at 22. Because many races are hotly contested, campaigning in North Carolina can be more expensive. And there are also voters' potential reaction to the candidate's age. Hughes first ran for city council at 25 and remembered one voter who commented Hughes was the same age as his son. But many people were excited to see a young person running, he said. Posada says he feels more pushback about his Latino identity than his age. Some critics have said he brings race into the conversation too much, he said. Young candidates do better when people their age vote, according to the Electoral Studies Journal. In North Carolina, millennials and Gen Z voters have the lowest voter turnout. But in the 2018 midterm elections nationally, younger generations outvoted the more senior baby boomers, reports the Pew Research Center. A candidate's success sometimes boils down to resources, which can break down along racial lines. ANLAR's research also showed the racial breakdown of young congressional candidates is generally proportional to the population, but the non-white candidates are more likely to lose their races. Hughes says that's because white candidates tend to have more access to resources and funds. To increase their candidates' chances of success, Johnson said the parties should get young people into government at the local level first and advised young leaders to think about the timing of their campaigns. He said, "The biggest mistake I see young candidates make is they get in their head they want to run for something, but then they go up against someone who's very established and has done a good job. And you make a lot of enemies within your grassroots and your inner parties, and your inner party, the folks that if you just waited one more time, they might actually be looking for somebody to fill that role and would be on board. So timing is everything." Some young candidates struggle to stay in office because of burnout and low pay, said Reed Howard, Vice President of Strategy and Public Affairs at the Millennial Action Project. Pay depends on the style of legislature. Citizen legislatures tend to have smaller staff, and elected officials who work full-time jobs outside of lawmaking at typically lower pay. North Carolina's hybrid model means legislators' time commitment is more than a part-time job, and their compensation is slightly higher than a true citizen legislature, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. But North Carolina legislators receive some of the lowest compensation in the nation, reported WCNC, just under $14,000 yearly in base salary. ANLAR found that young people are more likely to run for offices that offer better wages. The hours and pay of the North Carolina legislature can be more difficult for lawmakers to handle than other similar state houses because it's harder to maintain a full-time job. But the pay isn't as much as other legislatures with better compensation. Murdoch, a consultant, maintains a flexible schedule due to unexpected voting calls. She's seen officials leave for better-paying roles or quit due to financial constraints. She said, "The way I phrase it is, what if we are missing out on the next Ayanna Pressley, Stacey Abrams, Ilhan Omar, because we didn't figure out a way to keep them in office because they were in jeopardy of losing their home?" Posada considered running for the General Assembly but couldn't afford to live on that salary alone, and the time commitment would mean he could not keep his job. He said the system favors the wealthy and needs change. Quote, we'll continue to see the same results. Rich white people who have the ability to retire and serve in office and spend their time without any compensation or minimum are going to be the ones that continue to hold the power in North Carolina. Bradfield from Run for Something said the frequently changing legislative maps in North Carolina make recruitment difficult. It's hard to persuade someone to run in an uncertain district, he said. North Carolina has been known as one of the most gerrymandered states in the country since the 1990s, an analysis by Democracy Docket found. And as we know, gerrymandering is when electoral districts are drawn to favor one party over another. Under a gerrymandered map, the 2012 election resulted in more Republicans than Democrats in the North Carolina delegation, the analysis stated. Those seats had been evenly split between the parties prior to that redrawn map. After years of litigation over the maps, the NC Supreme Court reversed its own decision and allowed partisan gerrymandering in the state, reported Politico. Critics argued that the North Carolina High Court's decision was a blow to black voters and democracy. At the state level, Murdoch's races were affected by redrawn maps. She first ran for Senate because redistricting opened a seat and later moved to South Durham because she knew the maps would change again. Despite canvassing in downtown Durham and at Duke University, those areas were drawn out of her district and she lost those connections. Johnson said he was also at a disadvantage because of redistricting. Still, he secured the seat. "It was the worst possible situation. I got double bunked with another incumbent, a Republican who had been there twice as long as I had and had represented a majority of the district," he said. Anlar said, "One benefit of young elected leaders is they tend to legislate and connect with voters differently. Research shows they often use social media to communicate with constituents, which helps them gain name recognition among voters and are more bipartisan in tackling issues. They also are more likely to push to modernize the legislature, such as streaming meetings online," she said. Howard said the Millennial Action Project focuses on lowering polarization by connecting young lawmakers of different parties. The organization formed Future Caucus, a network of millennial legislators in multiple states focused on issues facing younger generations. Murdoch is part of the NC Future Caucus and said the group helped her find common ground with Republican State Senator David Craven Jr., a Republican of Anson, on the issues of child care and affordable housing. Murdoch said the younger generation brings lived experience to current issues. When she was elected, she was still paying off student loans. She saw her apartment in Durham double in price and is part of the gig economy, as are many millennials. She also said some of the legislation affects her more personally, like the limits on abortion, as she would likely have a high-risk pregnancy if she does decide to have kids. Murdoch is hopeful about contributions from future Generation Z lawmakers in the State House. She pointed to the successful campaign of Florida Democrat Maxwell Frost, who gained attention as the first Gen Z lawmaker in the United States Congress. Frost has called for public financing of campaigns. While groups like Run for Something can provide added support to young candidates, their recruits face an uphill climb given the rigors and expense of campaigning. Meanwhile, Bradfield said young candidates should not wait to get politically involved. Bradfield says, "A lot of millennials and Gen Z have been told we need to wait our turn, but I feel like our time is now. The burden of the future we have to live in, with all the broken systems, the broken environment, we have to be the ones that bear the burden of carrying our country and society through them." Oh, one or two sort of, not marginal, but cultural articles. One is a book review. And it's a book review of Death by Talons. Mark Pinsky writes, and when I first downloaded this, I thought it was about owls. It makes an unconvincing case for the owl theory. So I was agog to learn what owl theory was, and it turns out, well, you'll see. As many indie readers may recall, writes Mark Pinsky, the novelist Michael Peterson returned to Durham in the late 1980s, where, as an outspoken newspaper columnist and an unsuccessful candidate for mayor, he became a well-known man about town. Then, in 2001, his wife Kathleen was found dead in the family's Forest Hills home at the base of a staircase. Given my experience covering murders on both U.S. coasts, beginning with racial injustice and death penalty cases in North Carolina in the 1970s, this case should have been my story. I missed intersecting with Peterson at the Duke Chronicle by just a year, in the mid-60s. In 1995, I joined the staff of the Orlando Sentinel covering religion for a change. With family responsibilities in Central Florida, marriage, mortgage, young children, I didn't feel free to return to Durham to cover the case in the trial. Nevertheless, I did follow it and could feel the pull, even if I was unable to act on it. From a distance, though, the case's trajectory to media prominence was familiar. Murders like these often generate a kind of perverse civic pride in middle-sized cities. Although I didn't participate, I watched this media dynamic unfold at close hand in 2008 in Orlando with the Casey Anthony murder case, where a petite young white woman murdered her 2-year-old daughter and, possibly with the assistance of her parents, buried the body in the woods. Anthony was acquitted because of a botched investigation and inept prosecution. National and international attention to the case was unceasing, especially from cable crime meister Nancy Grace. Of course, the truth was that if Casey Anthony had been a poor black woman and her daughter a black child, there would have been no sensational coverage. Similar, it seems to me, if Mike Peterson hadn't been an outspoken white writer and decorated veteran, silver and bronze stars, but no documentation for the 2 Purple Hearts he claimed, and a Durham personality, the story would have been unlikely to attract interest beyond the Triangle. Sensational murder cases like the Pattersons have always attracted their share of true crime groupies and opportunists. But in recent years, the explosion of interest in true crime has spawned a whole subculture of amateur sleuths who use the internet to crowdsource their own parallel investigations. And wherever passion, popular culture, and commerce intersect this way, there are those who will exploit it. Which brings us, at long last, to the owl and a new book, Death by Talons. Did an owl murder Kathleen Peterson? By T.D. Smith from Wild Blue Press. With this book, Smith has parlayed what was essentially a ludicrous footnote into his ticket to the true crime show. He tries to make a serious case for his thesis, but it largely rests on a shaky structure of owl feathers, pine needles, and bits of talons, now mostly missing, or, he says, hidden. After 40 years away, I moved back to Durham in 2021 and was recently asked to review Death by Talons. My initial reaction to the request, that I was being asked to go after an ant with a ball-peen hammer. In 300 pages, Smith explores in granular detail what was at first glance perhaps the most ludicrous theory of how a murder was committed, an avian attack. The theory was developed and championed by Larry Pollard, a respected North Carolina prosecutor and Peterson's next-door neighbor at the time of the murder. In brief, Pollard believes that Kathleen Peterson was the victim of an owl attack in the front yard of her Forest Hills mansion. The raptor, he claims, continued its attack as Peterson ran through her front door, collapsing and then bleeding to death at the foot of her staircase. His chief evidence is that, viewed in a certain way, the lacerations on Peterson's scalp roughly lined up with barred owl talons, and what could have been fragments of avian feathers were found around her ear. Also, two fragments, never analyzed, that may have been chips of an avian talon embedded in Kathleen's skull. Smith, the author, is a New Zealand philosopher of religion now living in Indonesia, where he specializes in animism and the relationship between science and religion. While it's not clear if he has forensic training or ever visited Durham, Smith has at least marshaled and presented the theory with skill. No one can own a subject. Smith states his theory on the book's first page. Let me be brief. An owl killed Kathleen Peterson. Still, he acknowledges, after viewing HBO's The Staircase, my first impression had been that Michael Peterson probably killed his wife. Hell, it was the only sensible conclusion. The only alternative was that drunk Kathleen fell down the stairs. It wasn't a fall. If it wasn't a fall, then Michael did it. Understandably, given his circumstances, the owl theory became the subject of widespread ridicule when Pollard championed it. At the time, Smith writes, he was no exception. His first impression was that, quote, it's a crazy idea. Let me rephrase that. That shit crazy. Then he came to be persuaded. The result, the well-written death by talons, may reduce the ridicule, but it does not do much to enhance its credibility. Smith repeats one of the most famous and overused of Sherlock Holmes' quotes. When you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. No disrespect to the sage of Baker Street, but barring a confession from the owl, I am not persuaded. Along the way, Smith makes some valid observations. For one, when investigators settle on a likely scenario of any crime, it is almost impossible to shake them from it, as in the Peterson case. In support of his thesis, Smith goes into great detail about the chaos of the crime scene and the many mistakes police and investigators made. To anyone who knows anything about murder scenes, this is not news, much less revelation. Lives are often in the balance in the critical minutes before a crime scene becomes a death scene. Clearly, officers of Durham Police did not cover themselves with glory in processing the crime scene. In this case, the charge, often repeated by criminal defense attorneys, that they handled the crime scene like Keystone cops seems justified. Their work at the house that day was incompetent, if not something more sinister. Smith charges that they conspired to conceal and tamper with evidence to build a case against Peterson, theorizing that some of these investigative mistakes may have been intentional suppression, payback for Peterson's outspokenness. He had, after all, made his feelings about the Durham police abundantly clear well before his wife's murder, both in print and on the stump. Then, there's the issue of whether Peterson himself staged the death scene. Well, anyone who writes novels is certainly capable of staging a murder scene. These lingering inconsistencies in the case tempt an amateur like Smith to try to solve it. However, I have learned in covering murders for half a century and have to acknowledge that essentially I too am an amateur, a civilian in this racket, albeit one with a lot of experience in the field. This insight has served me well because amateurs are what jurors are. I'm not a cop or a lawyer, nor I have a desire to be one. It's true that patterns of human behavior repeat, though not immutably. So I understand the urge of Smith and other true crime buffs. My first book-length examination of an unsolved cold case murder, Met Her on the Mountain, dealt with the unsolved kidnap, rape, and murder of Vista worker Nancy Morgan in Madison County. I'm now working on my... Excuse me. I'm sorry for that. let's see. That was Daffy Duck playing so now I won't explain that any further. But in the middle of this book review, the author says one of the things he's learned along the way, even in the most tightly constructed prosecution cases, there are inexplicable loose ends, often unresolved and unexplained. Naturally, these are exploited by defense attorneys, arguing reasonable doubt to jury and to juries. And so it is with the apparent owl-like lacerations and owl feather fragments, if that's what they are. As one might expect, there is a certain amount of non-owl padding in this 300-page book. Smith relies heavily on speculation rather than analysis. This padding takes the form of lengthy sections about the investigation and trial that have nothing to do with the owl theory. In it, Smith builds a brief for Peterson's innocence. On one element of the state's case, he writes, "At best, this was circumstantial evidence of the weakest sort." Implicitly at first and then explicitly later, the author says, this supports the Pollard-Smith-Owl theory of the case. As Death by Talon's narrative unfolds, Smith is much less categorical in his conclusions than he is on the opening page. The owl theory may sound improbable to an intelligent person, but at least it is not impossible. He acknowledges and accepts the consensus that Peterson is a liar and a self-aggrandizing blowhard, writing later that Michael's alibi strains credulity. It is almost certainly false. Nevertheless, Smith writes, when the evidence is seen for what it is, the hypothesis that Kathleen was killed by a bird of prey outcompetes any other theory. The book's end is and is fatally undermined by a chapter that imagines and recreates a tortured scenario that accounts for all the physical evidence found at the scene. This is where the implausibility is brought into sharpest relief. Well, police conspiracy to remove evidence of the owl attack, quote, painstakingly clearing the scene of reddish-tan feather quills one at a time. In Scottish courts, jurors have a third opinion of verdicts besides guilty and not guilty, the one that I think applies to this theory, and that is not proven. And that's all the time I have for Indie Week. John Feddersen saying it's available as a podcast after this initial broadcast on Friday. But we'll be back next week with the Indie Week for you. So long.